Hey everyone, this is Kim File from Soundgarden, and you're listening to Life Minute TV.
Responsible for those rip-roaring riffs and that unmistakable sound, legendary musician and guitarist Kim File says he had to practice about a dozen or so old Soundgarden songs to prepare for Rock and Roll Fantasy Camp's latest romp, Sounds of Seattle, the camp that gives real people the once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to connect and jam with their musical heroes. We caught up with File earlier to hear all about it, what else he's up to, and more. This is a Life Minute with Soundgarden's Kim File. Hello.
Hi, how's it going?
Hey, Kim. Oh, this is so cool. So how's life been for you?
Oh, probably similar to how it's been for the rest of the country or world. You know, it's kind of slowed down and a little bit less active, you know, socially, and which is just fine. You know, I'm sure if you actually interviewed a number of professional musicians, you'd find that they're in their comfort zone. You know, guitars, records, books, movies, probably a struggle for people who work in offices. But the biggest change is just not really, you know, seeing friends or family as frequently.
Well, hopefully it's going away, moving past it again.
Yeah. It has its pluses.
Yeah, that's true.
Of course, so many of our peers are not working. They're not able to tour.
They're
creative. They're finding new ways to get their music heard, you know.
And tell us about Rock and Roll Fantasy Camp.
I've only participated in Rock and Roll Fantasy Camp on my end in terms of parodies and satires that I participated in for a couple different TV shows. I think I did a live action sketch comedy in the 90s along with Mike McCready and Dave Grohl, where we were here in Seattle on a show called Almost Live, where they did a skit called Rock and Roll Fantasy Camp. I was on stage playing Black Hole Sun with a few of the show's comedians attempting to sing. They had their shirts off like Chris, you know? So they took their shirts off and flabby comedian guys singing Black Hole Sun. And back in 2012, maybe 13, I did an episode of the Brendan Small's TV show Metalocalypse on Adult Swim. It's animated, featuring the animated adventures of a fictitious metal band from the future called Death Clock. And that was a lot of fun. And I voiced I guess a host or MC of a rock and roll fantasy camp. And I played a blues guitar, depressed blues guitarist. So that's my understanding of Rock and Roll Fantasy Camp, is participating in some comedy sketches.
What about Sounds of Seattle? How does that work?
I relearned a dozen or so Soundgarden songs, which is kind of weird doing it out of context. Obviously, I wasn't getting together with Matt and Ben, and I don't have Chris as a very significant reference we were really good at helping each other remember which parts were performed by whom. So we would help each other remember our guitar parts, like, oh, you played that and I played this. So I'm trying to remember my parts and in some of the songs that Chris played on, trying to remember some of his parts. Obviously I can't play them both at the same time, but I'll try.
Well, let's talk about you now. Any guitarists out there that you particularly like?
Growing up, I think, you know, I like George Harrison when I was a kid, and I like Ace Frehley from Kiss. But by the time I started playing guitar in my mid to late teens, I mean, I was really into, you know, Wayne Kramer and Fred Sonic Smith from the MC5. I really like Johnny Ramone and Steve Jones and Johnny Thunders from New York Dolls. And as I started learning more about guitar and about what my abilities were, it really just opened up, because I was really into the, you know, punk rock and some, I guess, some, you know, I guess at the time we kind of called it either industrial or art rock bands like Peru Boo and Chrome. But they weren't really the kind of band that presented guitar heroes, but I loved the guitar work. Of course, I went back and started rediscovering a lot of classic rock guitarists that I'd overlooked in the 70s, because I was too young and, you know, the son of immigrants. It's not like they had a great, you know, classic rock record collection. And I'd have to say that I've come away with like really loving Jeff Beck. I mean, Jeff Beck's one of my favorite guitarists. And in the past, probably the past couple of decades, and I don't want to leave people out. There's so many amazing players, but I'm really impressed with Derek Trucks, the side player. You know,
a lot of people say his name.
I mean, he does a lot of raga music and blues, of course, and jazz. And Derek Trucks is influenced by, you know, Indian music, free jazz, and that's pretty impressive. And he's so soulful. And his wife Susan Tedeschi writes great songs. And I do not want to leave anybody out because there are so many incredible players and bands that I know the minute we get off our interview, I'm going to think of a dozen people. Why didn't I mention them? But that's what's coming to mind right now. Pretty impressive guys. Obviously, I mean, Jimmy Page and Jimi Hendrix are in there, and amongst, you know, metal guys, you know, from the 80s, I really liked, you know, obviously people like Kirk Hammett, Scott Ian, James Hetfield. I mean, I think in the 80s, when I was a kid, in my 20s, a lot of the bands were forming in Seattle. People are pretty impressed by Hetfield's right hand and the rhythm guitar, how the sound and the precision. I think that was a big deal. I used to love Chris Kirkwood from a band called the Meat Puppets and Paul Leary from the Butthole Surfers. They're both pretty inspiring to me in the mid to late 80s, definitely.
What about Prince?
Yeah, that's a curious one. You could start a lot of arguments there. I like Prince as a songwriter. I think he's an amazing songwriter, very, 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 very prolific. I had this conversation with a friend of mine a friend of mine who likes Prince, who also happens to be a biochemistry professor. He's like asking me, what do you think of Prince as a guitarist? I feel like he's underrated. What do you think? And I said, he's incredibly underrated as a guitarist for those who don't recognize him as a talent, as a guitar player. Mm-hmm. For those who do recognize him as a talented guitar player, I think they overrate him. Does that make sense?
I think he needs to be recognized
as a good guitar player. He's underappreciated and under-recognized as a guitarist amongst a lot of the rock and roll crowd. Of those that do recognize him, they overappraise him. If there's any inspiration that I got from Prince's work, it's from his songwriting and his falsetto on early albums like Dirty Mind, and not from his guitar playing.
When did you know you wanted to be a guitarist?
I guess when I realized the cool sounds on Beatles albums were not being made by an electric keyboard, but by a guitar. So when I was younger, I just assumed it was all, you know, electric keyboards, a bright, shiny red plastic electric thing like you would see.
Like I have behind me.
Yeah.
I have my 11-year-old props behind me here. I'm not trying to impress you here. It's
the kind of thing that, as a kid, I might have seen it on the Partridge Family or the Monkees, you know what I mean? Like, these are 70s. Yeah. And I think that's what I wanted to play, because that's what I thought the cool stuff on the Beatles and the Monkees, and even on a Yes song called "A Roundabout," I thought, oh, Rick Wakeman is playing this cool keyboard. But then I learned as I got older that the parts I was hearing that I thought were keyboards was guitar. It was Steve Howe on guitar, George Harrison. So I want to be a guitar player. And then it really came home, I think, when I became a fan of Kiss, like when I was 14 or 15, I thought, oh, that'd be so fun to do. They make that look so fun. And from what I understood from friends of mine that played guitar, they thought, well, that's not, I remember they would say, there are a lot of, Kiss was one of those bands that you either loved or hated. And I happened to be one of the guys that loved them. But a lot of my friends who play guitar say they didn't think much of their songs and thought that's not challenging. They may have been more into the Allman Brothers, you know, or early Fleetwood Mac, you know, with Peter Green's band. And so I thought, I learned a few of their songs. I thought, I could do this, you know, and it looks like it's fun to do this. So that's probably ultimately what made me save up my lunch money and go out and buy a guitar.
How old were you and how did you learn to play? Were you self-taught or?
Yeah, self-taught. I think, well, you know, the first stuff I learned, I had a girlfriend who had an electric, guitar, and she would kind of play like, you know, folky songs on it. She showed me, you know, a lot of initial chords, like, you know, C and G and D. And she let me practice on the guitar. And then I got my own guitar and just got a book of chords and kind of practice them. Watch bands play on TV, listen to the radio and screw around the guitar. If I did something that sounded familiar, I try to remember it. That sounds like that thing in that song, or this passage sounds like what I saw that guy playing, or sounds like what I'm hearing. So that's kind of it, just really from watching people. Every once in a while you get to see your friends play or their older brothers playing in their band, and you just watch what their fingers are doing and go home and try to imitate it, you know.
Were your parents supportive of it, of you playing?
That's kind of weird, because sort of kicking and screaming. I mean, my mom is a music teacher, so she was really happy that I was learning. But I was self-taught. She didn't teach me anything. And other than generally creating a place and an understanding within myself of the value of music and the arts. So within that context, I was able to, you know, nurture my interest, but it was entirely a private thing. It wasn't something that wasn't parentally, you know, sanctioned at all. If anything, there were some obstacles, because they certainly didn't want my pursuit of guitar to interfere with my homework or with getting a real job. So I think my dad was probably would have preferred that I wasn't spending all my time in a garage jamming with my friends, and would have preferred that, you know, I concentrated what I wanted to do when I grew up, you know, and get a regular job. So yeah, I think it was until he probably saw me on TV that he thought, oh, now I get it. Yeah. Well, my mom was, she was proud all along, but, you know, she was surprised that most of what I did was independent of her, so.
And you had a bunch of bands before you started Soundgarden, so tell us about those and take us into it.
Well, I was kind of into punk rock, and surprisingly, it had, you know, the power and aggression, and which is great for me as a young teenage boy, and was a little bit easier to learn. I mean, once you had the dexterity to play these chords really fast, the songs weren't as overwhelming as trying to learn a Hendrix song or a Zeppelin song. So it happened to be what I liked. Punk rock kind of came out in 1977. I was 16. I was learning guitar. It was perfect. This is learnable, and it just so happens to what I like. It happened to be what I like listening to, because it has all those powerful, distorted, energetic, heavy, fast chords. It was perfect for me. My first band was called Bozo and the Pinheads, and I wrote we did a few covers, and then all the originals, I wrote all the music and half of the lyrics. I split the lyrics duties with our singer, Dan. And then I was in another band. I started another band a few years later called Identity Crisis. Same deals, almost all originals. I think we did some Who songs and Kink songs and Ramon songs, but mostly originals. And everybody, the singer wrote, I wrote, the bass player wrote. I have to say the majority of the music was written by me, and I think a lot of the lyrics are written by me, but our singer wrote a lot of lyrics and he also wrote music. So it was, but once again, those were all kind of power chord, sort of punk rock, power pop type songs. Very different from the way I'd write instrumentally with Soundgarden, which is a little bit more involved and a little bit more dynamic.
Mm-hmm. Well, how did Soundgarden come to be?
You know, we all knew each other. Hiro Yamamoto and I moved from Chicago to Seattle. And around college age, I was 21, he was 20. And we just wanted to move far away from Chicago. And we knew there's some cool music going on in the Olympia, Washington area at the time, bands like the Beakers and Student Nurse, the Blackouts, the Three Swimmers, just, you know, indie punk rock bands whose records we were turned on to by Bruce Pavitt, the future founder and eventual founder of Sub Pop Records. So we moved out here, got jobs, met other musicians, and met Chris through one of my roommates, who was another guitar player who was playing in a Rolling Stones, Doors, Hendrix cover band. Eventually we started getting together and jamming. Hero and Chris moved into a house together. They invited me to come by and play guitar with them. Here, Chris was a drummer. Hero was a bass player, so they were a rhythm section. So the drummer and bass player are jamming, and they want guitarists to play with. So they invite me to come by, and I came by on two consecutive days. We wrote like five songs, just really quickly, spontaneously. It was the best stuff any of us had ever done. We'd all been in plenty of bands, and this was the most inventive for me, the most challenging. I was writing differently than I did. I wasn't writing these power chord rock songs, you know, in the vein of Ramones or Sex Pistols or even The Who or The Kinks. Things were a little bit, you know, using different elements of guitar playing, maybe more arpeggios, harmonics, using more space and having some songs be more bass oriented. Chris started writing lyrics and would sing and play drums. And everyone, we were all giddy. We're giddy with smiles and probably Rainier beer. But we were all looking at each other thinking, geez, I've never been in something that happened so effortlessly and so inventively, you know. And so we just kept playing together and the songs kept coming, and I was writing all the guitar parts, Hero's writing the bass parts, Chris is writing the lyrics and helping the arrangements out with the drums. So yeah, that was that. And then we thought, well, let's go play for our friends, you know. Yeah. I could still be writing, you know, Ramones, AC/DC type songs, you know, had it not been for playing with, you know, Hero and Chris, which allowed me to explore other things about my guitar playing.
Then Matt came in.
Chris wanted to concentrate on either singing. It was kind of tough to do both, sing and drum. He really wanted to focus on singing. We wanted him to focus on drums because we liked the way he wrote as a drummer. We liked his lyrics. You know, at the time we thought, you know, Chris was young. He was younger than us. So he probably still needed a little bit more experience with as a wordsmith. But his melodies were great. His sensibility for how to wrap a melody around the weird rhythms that Hero and he and I were coming up with was amazing. So we wanted him to drum, and so that his ability to arrange with us was still there. We thought, we'll get another singer, you know. But Chris really pushed to sing. So we thought we'd try that out. We got another drummer, and the drummer was really good, but his sensibilities weren't quite like Chris. But Chris's singing that he really took off, being in the front of the stage, we weren't sure, is he gonna be nervous? Is he gonna be awkward, or is he gonna be comfortable? A little bit awkward, but it seemed comfortable, and he's confidence built, and you know, so it was great. Then Matt joined in late 87, early 87. And he was so versatile. He was doing some of the stuff that Chris was doing with us early on, but more so. He was certainly, Chris is a good drummer, Matt's a great drummer, you know, he's the best. And so our early songwriting sensibilities, we could start exploring again.
Then what? Then Hero left and...
But he left, he had other things going on in his life. He had a significant, you know, relationship, girlfriend. He was interested in going to college. Just a lot of stuff. I don't think he wanted to be on tour all the time. So he left, and eventually we got Ben, and that became the classic lineup. Ben's sensibilities musically were quirky and both powerful, but also smart and odd in ways that Hero was, or in ways that Matt and I appreciated. Meaning, you know, he was playing bass and appreciated elements of music that in a way that Hero did, and certainly in a way that Matt and I and Chris did. That helped revive the songwriting and creative instincts that we had that had kind of, you know, disappeared during the period where Hero was extricating himself from the process.
That grunge explosion, how did that even happen? Like,
a whole series of accidents and intentionalities. A song like Nevermind gets played on radio and people go crazy for it. You know, they love the video and the song, and there already was a buzz about Seattle because of stuff that we'd done and Green River had done and Nirvana, eventually Tad, Sub Pop Records was generating a lot of buzz. And then out come, you know, really it was Nevermind and 10 by Pearl Jam. Alice in Chains had been touring around. So there's a pretty good buzz about Seattle to begin with. And it was just bubbling under. And, you know, a generation of music fans were kind of being ignored because the record companies were focusing on the baby boom generation, looking for new Beatles or new Aerosmith or whatever. They're kind of ignoring the fact that millions and millions of records are being sold to fans of rap, and a lot of the indie rap labels were selling records, and labels like SST and Sub Pop and Touch and Go were selling indie punk rock, post punk, alternative music. And then you had these indie labels selling metal bands, you know, like Metallica was on Megaforce. So the major labels weren't paying attention to what the kids were listening to. It just took something like the Beastie Boys and then, you know, Faith No More, then eventually, you know, Smells Like Teen Spirit to address that audience. And then the whole music world was all surprised. They were surprised because they didn't realize that there was gold in them dar hills. There was a whole music buying populace that had been ignored by the older baby boomer record company people. It's like, yeah, there are people who like music that isn't the music you grew up with, you know. And that's what happened. And Nirvana, that song and their success really opened for the doors for all the other bands that people were aware of and were listening to, but now they reached a broader audience by getting on MTV and commercial radio. Bands like Alice in Chains and Us, the Smashing Pumpkins, Tool, Rage Against the Machine eventually, you know. So grunge was just a generic label that referred to bands from Seattle in general, but also included bands like, you know, Smashing Pumpkins and the Stone Temple Pilots get thrown in with grunge a lot. And they were LA, and Pumpkins were Chicago.
Yeah.
There's certainly a cultural aesthetic that we shared with all those bands. But I think musically, the idea of a big power chord is all fuzzy and distorted. I think Nirvana might embody the musical identity of grunge. Maybe the band that best embodied grunge, I would think, is Mudhoney. Mudhoney's sound and their style and attitude, that's like the prototypical, the archetypal grunge band. The Pumpkins certainly have those elements, Nirvana. It was only grunge in that we came from the same place and we were friends of those guys and we played the same venues, we played the bills together. And so.
What's your favorite Soundgarden song and album?
That changes all the time. Often Matt and I will say Screaming Life, which was our first one, because there's something about there's a shimmer and ambience to that the producer Jack Endino captured. And something about those early songs in the spirit of that, where we were at that time, that really stands out. So often we'll say Screaming Life, and I used to say Super Unknown a lot. But in recent years, maybe in the past 5 or 6 years, I re-explored Bad Motorfinger. That kind of became like my favorite record.
And
there are a lot of things like on King Animal, and probably the top three are Screaming Life, Bad Motorfinger, and Super Unknown. My favorite song, that's a real tough one too. It depends on whether I'm playing it, listening to it, whether it's with the band or with an audience. Slaves and Bulldozers is a fun song to play live. So is Beyond the Wheel. I really like the song Limo Wreck off of Super Unknown. There's some stuff on King Animal I like a lot. I like a non-state actor and Blood on the Valley Floor as... Gosh,
yeah, a lot.
Hopefully so. The switch opens off of down the upside. Uh-huh. That I think that's an amazing song that's sometimes overlooked by our fans, but I like the feel of that. It's very pretty, and it could almost be like a Christmas song. It's weird, like a dark Christmas song.
Is there still material that you recorded with Chris that's yet to be released, or what? I don't know if you could talk about that. Whatever happened with that?
Well, there's certainly stuff we've done live, you know, yeah. alternate takes, things that fortify a box set, you know.
And what about new stuff? Any plans for that? Will we see you guys recording or performing together again?
I think it's very likely that Matt and Ben and I will play together. I think we know that if the songs that we love that we did for, you know, decades with Soundgarden, if we're going to play those songs again or hear those songs the way we want to hear them, at best it'll be with at least the three of us. You know, that's the closest we're going to get at this point. So I think we'd want to re-explore that and then do that, you know, sometime in the future. And I think the three of us have interest in doing new things. We certainly like working together.
So. Awesome. That's great to hear. So great to hear. But what inspires you creatively?
It's so many different things. You know, in our young days, you know, Hero and Chris and I prided ourselves on not being inspired by rock song. And we didn't, our in terms of our writing, we took pride in not referencing the contemporary music. Although we would file things along. We'd write a song and say, oh, that sounds like a little bit of Bauhaus and a little bit of Husker Du, or this sounds like a Zeppelin thing. We would do that just because it was just geeky self-analysis. We would discuss, you know, motivations and inspirations, Hero and Chris and I. And rarely were we referencing, you know, a musical trend or a song. We weren't a rock band inspired by rock bands. We often thought that rock bands or pop bands inspired by rock and pop were kind of lame and imitative. And we certainly didn't want to be imitative. So we drew from other sources. There definitely were a few times where we would hear something and say, God, that's kind of cool. What this guy's doing on guitar, this kind of drum style that they're doing, this hip hop song. It's like, if we did an arrangement that was kind of like how this song is arranged, that'd be kind of cool to try that. Those experiments failed as often as they'd work, you know. If it worked, it made it to the record. If it failed, we play it live a few times and just kind of shelve it.
When you play and create music now, is it different in any way, or do you approach it differently in any way than when you were younger?
Yeah, definitely. When Soundgarden formed in 1984, I was immediately interested in playing guitar differently than I had been in the previous 6-7 years. And because of Chris and Hero, it allowed me to do that. And we were definitely a guitar band and a guitar-based band, as many rock bands are. So we're oriented towards what the vocals and guitar are doing, but the song structures it's definitely kind of a guitar riff, guitar sound oriented. So I think now there's probably things I've learned from playing with Matt or Chris or Ben or Hero, and there's probably new things I want to try. But definitely outside the context of playing with those guys, my songwriting is definitely going to be different. It really is within the context of who you're playing with. So it's not likely that I certainly could have instrumental parts and guitar parts are very Soundgarden-y, because our identity really came from the kind of guitar playing that we play in the early days, and it grew. So it's very likely that would be the case. But without Matt drumming, without Chris singing, it's going to be arranged differently and perhaps take on a different colors and different sounds. So.
Is there anyone you'd love to collaborate with?
There are people I'd love to collaborate with that I'm probably not good enough to collaborate with. And there's people that...
Oh, no way. Are you kidding?
Well, sometimes I wish I was good enough to be able to play jazz, but you know, I don't read music. You know, I'm self-taught. You know, so rocks, weird rocks, fine with me. It's great. I mean, I like playing with friends because often you share a background and interest. You know, with the you come from the same subculture. You like, you know, similar music and music and books. That's often a good place to start. But it's also good to play with people who come from a different perspective, and then you bounce ideas off of each other and something new might come out of it. So
is there something you want to do that you haven't done yet? Like, what do you think, what's next for you?
I certainly wouldn't want to do something that was along the lines of Soundgarden, because it's weird, because that's naturally the way I would write and play guitar. Like I said, we were a guitar band. I was the one guitarist for years. So naturally, I'm probably going to play in ways that are that way, but I don't necessarily want to pursue something that would be absent Chris or Matt. So part of me wants to like play with other people and see where that goes. Mm-hmm. My natural inclination would probably be to do something that sounded like the guitar work in Soundgarden. But once again, minus Chris's vocals and Matt's drumming and Ben's playing, you know, it just seems kind of weird.
What do you enjoy doing when you're not working or making music?
Normal life. I still love learning stuff. So you're reading, watching movies, or seem to watch the news a lot.
Oh, really? Wow. Anything you binge watch?
Maybe it's just because of the pandemic. Yeah, I've seen Walking Dead and Game of Thrones and Breaking Bad, all amazing stuff.
What's your favorite comfort food?
Oh, God, well pizza's a pretty easy one, right? But that's probably the first thing that comes to mind.
That's a good one. What about your favorite cocktail?
Oh, probably beer or red wine. Cider. I've been getting into cider a lot lately. Cocktail, probably the martini. You know, nice. Vodka martini. Oh, vodka martini and some oysters.
What would your current self tell your younger self?
There are probably a few doors that I chose not to open that perhaps I could have. Probably a few I'm glad I didn't, you know. And probably I kind of like the path that I've taken, even though most people see aspects of their life in which they could imagine it improving upon, or aspects of their life that they're not happy with. There's certainly some things, some occurrences and events that I'd want to change or prevent. But yeah, I don't know.
What's something no one knows about you?
Oh, nothing. I'm in a book. They know everything.
What's something you can't travel without?
Well, I usually have to take a book, whether I have time to read it or not, depending on what my reason for traveling is. You know, I just need to have it with me. It's almost like a security item, a security blanket.
What's your favorite place you've ever traveled to?
I have some cool memories of Prague, but that was like early 90s when it was just opening up. And when I've been there subsequently, it wasn't as naturally romantic. You know, its place became a little more commercial, I'd say. And interestingly, Tel Aviv and Jerusalem are both kind of interesting places to be. I think the most integrated place I'd ever seen in my life was Paris in the 90s. I was pretty surprised. I saw a lot of different kinds of dress and costume and ethnicities. And I thought that was pretty amazing. Perhaps one of the most civilized places I'd ever been in my life was Dublin. It was incredibly civil and it seemed rational and polite. And I loved that. Prague seemed like it was just opening up. Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, it was surprising because there was something that was both integrated, but also not. You know, it was like integrated for most or for some, and you can kind of get that vibe. But there's also something civil about it.
Since this is Life Minute, if you had to give us one of life's most valuable lessons or piece of advice, you know, just to be happy in your life or whatever simple thing it may be, what would it be?
You can't really control. There are a lot of contingencies in life, and you can't control the elements that are presented by, you know, natural occurrences, by other people's exercise of their will. You can only really address yourself. I think that's probably the best thing. You can really just better yourself and hopefully accommodate the interests of those around you in doing so. And other than that, you know, it's a combination of life sucks and life's great, and, you know, just try to, you know, maximize the positive, not simply selfishly for yourself, but certainly you want to start with accommodating family members and probably neighbors and coworkers and friends and bandmates and guys on the baseball team.
Yeah. You're amazing, and been a huge fan for many years. Thank you so much for taking the time. It's an honor and a pleasure.
Well, right on. Thanks a lot.
Okay, bye.
To see more of this interview, visit our website, lifeminute.tv. And don't forget to subscribe to our podcast, Life Minute TV.